probably not too likely.
Hi, my name's Henry Griffin. I'm 36 years old. Today is May 8th, 2006. We are in Jackson Square, New Orleans, Louisiana, and I'm sitting here with my friend, Hart McNee.
Yeah, my name is Hart McNee, and I'm 63. Damn. And it's the same date, since I'm sitting across the table from him, I'm assuming it's the same date on this side of the table as it is on your side of the table, so we'll skip that. And where we are, we're together, and we're friends.
Tell me about the time you almost bought a gun.
That was twice. Once when I was in the Army, I went into this pawn shop, and I noticed that, like, the guys that they wouldn't mess with, the guy that they really wouldn't mess with, you had two lockers. One was your military stuff, and the other stuff was your civilian clothes. And in his locker, this guy was kind of a nutcase, he left a shoulder holster with nothing in it. And the message he was giving to the sergeants is, I own a gun. That was the message. So you kind of get into the violence of being in the Army. You get into it. You know, it's, but the problem is, of course, you really want to kill your own people. And that's, so I went into this pawn shop in El Paso, Texas, and I was looking at this. It was a Smith & Wesson 32 revolver. I said, man, that's really nice. And I still may get one. Anyway, that was the first time. And then I saw a Piccolo for the same amount of money. And I said, you know what, kill or life or death. So I chose life. So I got the Piccolo, which subsequently, my baby mama, for my son, I cheated on her. She threw it at me and she bent it in two. But that's what happened to the Piccolo. Anyway, sorry, Mary Lou. The second time was I was in Georgia when I was going away from the storm. And I thought, like, there was all this shit about, gunfights. And apparently there was some stuff. Apparently there was a gunfight over by Mimi's. But anyway, and I figured, like, well, I don't want to be the only guy without a gun if everybody else has got a gun. So I went into the store to buy a gun. And in Georgia, who would have thought? They have laws about guns. You know, you would have thought, like, Georgia, man, you could get anything, right? But you can't. So they, because I wasn't from Georgia, they wouldn't sell me a gun. And I thought, like, you know, as an American, should I give me my gun? Where's my gun? You know, but so I couldn't buy it. So I think I may buy a gun this time for the next storm.
But you knew how to fire a gun because you were in the service.
Oh, yeah, they teach you to fire guns in the service. That's one of the things they teach you. My uncle taught me to shoot. Actually, this is strange. You wouldn't believe this, being a sensitive musician type, but I was the second best shot in my unit, like 200 guys. And my score was significantly higher than Lee Harvey Oswald's. Now, you can do with that what you want. And then I went to Dallas and checked out the thing, you know, like I went and I looked at the shot, you know, and I went where I said, man, I don't think I could have made that shot myself. And I shoot like two, there's three medals you get for marksmanship. And I got the top one and he got the bottom one. So I don't think he did it. But that's not what you asked.
How'd you end up in the service?
They drafted me. Like, they just drafted me and I couldn't get out. The truth of it is they drafted me and I tried to get out on a conscientious objector. Though my father was in the Second World War. But, you know, we're like, you know, peace and love and all that stuff. And I don't believe in a war. Though I do believe it happens. Yeah, I believe in war, actually, but I don't believe it's a good idea. But they wouldn't go for that. You have to have, they were drafting everybody, you know, anybody. They needed so many bodies that they took me. But I actually went, had my parents drop me off at the place where you do the physical, and I went to a friend's house, and I hid out for 2 months. I thought about, like, do I want to go to jail? No. Do I want to really live in Canada, you know? It was kind of Canada or death, you know. So I since found out parts of Canada are really nice, you know. But I didn't know that at the time, so I went back and they drafted me. I had a list of all the drugs I took. It was like about 20 drugs, man, because you know, with LSD, DMT. If you're taking DMT, that stuff will knock you out. It's like instant LSD. It's like you're sitting there and whap, and all of a sudden you're, oh my God, you're on another channel. It's like they turn the channel when you're watching a presidential debate or something, and it's on all the channels. So you go from 6 to 4, and it's the same, but it's different. That's what it was like. Boom. Oh, my God, I'm on another channel. I'm not on the same channel with everybody else. But anyway, I gave him this long list of drugs, and he said, oh, that's okay. Huge list of drugs, you know, which I subsequently added other items to that list after I got out of the Army, but, and you know, filled it out. But anyway, so they drafted. They were drafting everybody. But I was in, I went into guided missiles. This is weird. They threw a guy out of my unit because he had a grandparent in Yugoslavia at the time. Tito was, I think, still there. Anyway, so they threw him out. My father used to do cartoons for the Socialist Labor newspaper. You know, cartoons with the bad guy would be like a guy that looked like from a Monopoly set with a top hat, you know, the industrialist guy, and then there'd be a guy like worker, and then there'd be some lame joke, some political. Anyway, he was like published in these radical things, and my mother had joined a communist party in the 30s. So I figured, oh, this is it, man. They're going to take me out of this missile unit and put me in some kind of line infantry thing. But they never did find out any of that stuff, and it was public record, really. So I was in a missile unit, and they... there was a confidential clearance. There's a top secret, secret, and confidential. And, you know, the regular guy that works. Apparently because they could put nuclear warheads on these things. So I got a clearance because then they teach you about these things and they're supposed to be secret, you know. You know, it was 22 feet long and had we'll talk about that later. Anyway, I guess all my secrets are pretty much, you know, obsolete now. Oh, another thing, man. At the place that they trained me for this, they had this big sign. We train the free nations of the world. And at the time they were training India and Pakistan in the same building, at the time, I think we're at war at the time. They were either after or about to have one. And they trained a number of Arab nations and Israel all in the same building, but not in the building I went to. So anyway, so I became, I was very, I hated the what do you call it? You go into a basic training, you know, basically it's very, very stressful. I mean, basically they scream at you all the time. And then try to make you feel like an idiot in front of everybody and make you feel like a fool. So you want to disappear. And so they would scream at you and harass you. So you try to become like invisible, you know. And that was very difficult. In fact, so difficult. They have this one thing, basic training, that is basically training for the First World War. They're still doing that. They're still training for the First World War, where they have these, at nighttime, they have these series of trenches and holes and stuff, and then a trench on the other side, like about 200-300 yards of mud, and then barbed wire, and then bombs in these barbed wire things exploding. And then they have machine guns firing live rounds, tracer bullets, so you can see them. And they're on a bar. The machine gun is on a bar, so it doesn't go, can't depress low enough to hit you, unless you stand up and jump around like a fool, and then you might get it. But anyway, I was so tired of people screaming at me and yelling at me that I crawled out into the middle. And this is like, you know, the middle of the night. We got like, you know, 400 guys going through this thing, and they're shooting machine guns and blowing up bombs. And I got halfway through, and I laid there for about 20 minutes, and I just went, because nobody could scream at you, you know. And another bad thing I did in basic training is I'm surprised I can put up with this because I'm kind of claustrophobic, and I wouldn't go into the gas chamber. They're still training you for the First World War, like I said, and so I wouldn't do it. And the sergeant says, you know, go in the gas chamber. I said, you know, I'm not doing it. because I was terrified. It was like a phobia, and phobia is really strong. I got a flying phobia, too. I won't get on a plane. And sergeant gets an officer, because a sergeant actually cannot legally give you an order. Only an officer can give you an order. So they bring over some lieutenant who usually knows a lot less than the sergeant. And he says, you want to do this? And I said, I won't do it. I said, but, you know, I do know one thing. You can put me in jail. You can do this. I just know one thing. I'm not going in there, you know. Because that's, you know, it was like that's how the fear was. And so I basically put everything on the line. And then they said, oh, hell with it. They just ignored me.
I have a question. Did you, you said you worked in missiles. What part of missiles did you work on?
I was trained, what was I trained to do? To fire them, I think. But I ended up working in the they needed somebody else in the radar part. Basically, it's a mobile missile system with a number of radars and a number of launchers. It's kind of interesting to have this, like, big radar that spins and picks up blips. And they have, like, a trailer, and guys sitting in a trailer looking at it, and they do all the firing. And you put these missiles on these automatic things, you know, and you load them up. They're like, what, 20 feet long and, you know, big around as a, you know, like a barrel. And then they pick it up, and then they have these access radars that... Then they put a cursor on it, and it, I don't think this stuff is, oh, well, this is, you know, this is going to the government. They already know this. And the cursor takes these two radars that you've set up and leveled, and you've aimed like a surveyor's type thing, and you get them all lined up and together and, you know, moving in tandem. And when you get them both pointing at the blip, you get a triangle. And so the two angles and the space between that, and then it figures out the distance for automatically with simple, like, you know, geometry stuff.
All right, I want to get back to what everybody knows about Hart McNee. How did you end up becoming a musician? What was your first instrument?
Ah, my first instrument. Well, first, to become a musician, I was growing up at a time where people were listening to Perry Como, right? So I hated music, basically. My mother listened to classical music and played piano. My father, he had a Kid Ory record he liked. So he liked, and he liked Ray Charles and stuff like that later on. Actually, he started to like stuff that I introduced him to. But he listened to basically that, and he sang goofy songs like Barney Google with a Google Googly Eyes, and Don't Throw... Cigars at Me. That was the pogo version. Anyway, so at 13, some friend that I don't know, a friend of my mother's or something, gave me a radio because I was a teenager, which I didn't want to be. I wanted to be a kid, and I didn't want to be a teenager, but there I was. What can you do? I didn't want to be 63 either, you know, but here I am. So they gave me this radio. I'm thinking, like, my God, music is so, I mean, Perry Como and all that kind of terrible pop music at the time, when you think about it, was just really, it wasn't even that classic stuff like Fred Astaire or anything real, just garbagey stuff, you know. So I really hated what the teenagers of the day were listening to. And I was living in Chicago. I live on the near north side of Chicago, in an area that's really kind of Tony now. It wasn't quite so Tony then, called Lincoln Park West, near Diversity and Clark. And so I got this radio, I turn it on, you know, might as well. And I turn it to the right side of the dial where the little cheap stations were. And it was like three black stations in Chicago. And one, you could get the Nashville station at night, like at 2 a.m. Anyway, I turn it over and I heard, like, they were playing like Otis Rush records and all this blues records, they had blues shows and stuff. And I never heard it, like I was 13. And really, it's true, when I heard that, it was like, I got a chill. You know, the difference between, like, you know, blah, 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 you know. And like, the blues, like, they were playing then was really raw, and it was new, and it was, you know, it was just a time when black people were listening to blues in Chicago, when it was, like, a lot of working-class black people, and white people hadn't discovered it yet. So I heard that, and I was, like, amazed. You know,
Do you remember what song it was that you heard first?
My first song.
The one that really made you chill?
Oh, God, I don't know what it was. But, you know, you hear they would have, like, black preachers where they would be talking like this, and half an hour later they'd be talking in a tone, like they'd be singing, really, on a couple of notes, you know? And that, like, I would listen to the whole thing. That was amazing to me. So I listened to that, and so your first thing is not only you want to play that music, you want to be those people. I wanted to be Otis Rush. I subsequently made a record with Otis Rush. So like 30 years later, no, 20 years later. It was like, wow, man. But anyway, so I heard this stuff, and so I got, my mother bought me a tenor sax. Con with a split B and a B flat, and it was like a really good horn, I think, which is stolen from me. But so I started honking on it, and like the first day, I got, there's two notes, and there was, at the time, Duane Eddy had this thing called Rebel Rouse or something like that. Bam, 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 bam. Then the next chorus. Bam, bam, da, 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 do, 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 bam, do, da. The tenor sax plays those two notes. I found them. So like the first day I found those two notes and I called my friend, played over the phone, you know. So then I started just learning the saxophone. I was a very, very lazy kid. And I've probably studied more in the last 6 years of real, like, focused study than I did in the beginning when I should have really focused. But I was, I don't know, you know.
Well, how'd you get ahead?
What do you mean?
How did you, if you say you didn't, because you definitely got to you became a professional saxophonist. And then I also want to ask about the flute. But how did you end up becoming a professional musician? Was it after you got out of the service?
Oh, no, no, no. Early. Because we started playing in my basement. We got two guys in the neighborhood, a drummer and a bass player. Bass player is, the drummer was terrible. So, well, he's an artist now, I think, so, you know, it wasn't his thing, but, you know, what do you expect? And the guitarist, who was still great, and we would get in the basement, it was like, it was cool, we thought it was cool, because it was like when you see those Saturday night horror movie things where they show in the old days, they'd show, on Saturday night, they'd have, like, some horror movie show with some guy going, yeah, now we're gonna, you know, and they would always be out of a basement, you know. Be some good. And so we'd be playing in the basement, blues in the basement. So we would just like learn tunes as little as we knew. And I'd learn a tune and then, or blues, a lot of blues. And I learned harmony from the guitarist. He taught me like how chords moved and the relationship of chords to keys. And chords are really complicated. I mean, you can really study them like, it's like a puzzle. And so I learned that from him. And then I went to a music teacher, Lillian Painish. And she was a clarinet player, classical, and she kind of taught me to read. And I was very bad. I was so lazy. I really regret how lazy I was as a young kid.
If you could say something to all the lazy kids out there, because now you have the wisdom of the ages.
Ah, yeah, that's true. I do.
Now you know how valuable your time is. Yeah, you wish you could go back and work harder. Do you think there's any way to get kids to work harder, or are they just built that way?
Well, I suggest that if you smoke weed, don't waste it. Practice. It's a lot of fun to practice when you smoke weed. So all those kids sitting around smoking weed, you practice when you're doing that and all. I think it sticks in your head better. I'm not sure, but but other than that, you know, you can't talk to kids. They won't listen to you, especially if you're 63. So it's pointless.
True enough. I didn't necessarily come in here thinking I was going to ask you about drugs, but I bet you would answer just about any question honestly.
Yeah, I would.
You've probably covered the spread.
Yes, I have. Not except crack. I stopped taking drugs before they invented it. And I'm glad, because that probably would have killed me.
Any regrets, or did you have a good time?
I got hepatitis C, and I kind of regret that. But I regret the drinking because my behavior was very bad when I drank, and I drank a lot. You really, taking heroin, I wouldn't recommend it. Both of my kids don't. My daughter's a moderate drinker. She grew up in New Orleans, moderate from New Orleans. And my son doesn't drink or take drugs. In fact, I was at Femi Cootie last night, and I turned to my daughter and said, "You want some of this?" And she said, "No." So we were smoking weed in the audience. But anyway, the problem with heroin, of course, you're pretty nice. Heroin addicts are usually pretty nice people. The problem is if you misjudge the dosage, you die. So that's real. You know, you're thinking like, how stupid am I, you know, to be doing this? But I can't say I really regret it, no. Now, the only thing, I don't drink. When I drank, I behaved very badly. I smoke some weed, that's it. Oh, excuse me. I'm strung out on morphine as we speak. I forgot about that.
Well,
I'm taking morphine because I got cancer.
I knew we were going to get to that. Tell me about how you got your diagnosis.
Oh, man, that was the worst moment in my life. Some of the worst moments in my life I've had in the last year when I found out about it, and some of the best, too. But I was bleeding from, you know, my anus, you know, and we thought it was something else. Anyway, I was hoping it was something else. I just went to his office, and he looked at the things. He says, "You got cancer." Man, I just sat there and cried like a baby, like a baby, like a little baby. It was like somebody sitting there saying, "Man, you're dead. You know, you're having fun." Because I'm pretty good shape for 63. I was like running 3 miles every other day. I lifted weights. I was living a very healthy life, really. Like I said, I don't drink. I haven't had a drink in 18 years. I never had a drink in New Orleans. Been here 16 years. I stopped 2 years before I got here. Man, it's like being in some horrible soap opera and you got the worst part, you know, and you're in it and you know what it's like? You can't get out. It's like I got claustrophobia. It's the same kind of fear of not being able to get out. And cancer is a thing you can't, in my case, it had moved. I didn't take one test that I should have taken because it was a very unpleasant test. None of this stuff is fun, I'll tell you, none of it is fun. But I took this test and so I had cancer and it's moved so they can't cure it. Yeah, I got it in my colon and it moved to my, I expect to get something in my liver, but it didn't start there because of the drugs. And then it went to my, and I used to smoke. I don't smoke anymore. And I got some in my lungs. So they can't, at this point in medical, whatever, one guy said I had 6 to 18 months to live. It's like, oh my God. And it was a horrible moment because you know what it is? It feels like you're totally alone. It's like the second they say you are going to die soon. Now they give me 4 years. Which, I don't know, is that a lot or a little? But when the second you get that, it's like you're different from everybody else. It's like everybody else is living life, they're having fun, blah, blah, blah. And you're this person who has got a death sentence, and you can't get out. You're on this boat going over a cliff, you know, over a falls or something. You can't get out of it. But after a while, it's weird. It really happens. First, you feel like, oh, my God, why me, why me, why me? And then you walk around like a zombie. You're just like numb. And then you get to a point, I swear I got to it too, where you say, okay, my children love me. Even my ex-wife loves me. All my ex-girlfriends still love me. You know, I went out and made a CD of stuff I wanted to do. And I had one CD already, and I made another CD, and I had that, and I said, well, okay, I'm ready. I can die. I'm cool with it. And then they said, well, maybe we can, like, keep you going for a while. And then I had to get out of that mode and go into the fighting mode, which is tough because it involves being active, fighting against it, and a lot of very unpleasant medical things they do to you. Everything they do is unpleasant, the doctors.
I have a question. I think a lot of people spend their time thinking about how they're going to die and when they're going to die. Being told that you're going to die of cancer in 4 years or 18 months or whatever, does that make you less afraid of flying?
You know, you would think it would, wouldn't you? No, you're still a coward about the same stuff. You know? Yeah, it doesn't help. That's too bad, isn't it? At least not for me. It didn't help. It doesn't give me any more courage or more able to face death. Ha ha! You know, in the face of, you know, stand back, I'll take care of it. No, you can't. It doesn't work like that, unfortunately. You're just the same, you know, sniveling, craven coward that you always were.
How did you pick what songs were going to be on your CD?
Huh.
Like you said, these were things that you wanted. What was it about that made you prepare?
Well, you know, I'm going to do another CD. When I get through this, I got to do 4 more months of chemo. And I'm going to get out, and I'm going to do another CD that is going to be even more what I wanted to do. I don't know. It was tunes I was playing with Sobel. It was just two. We were doing a bunch of Thelonious Monk tunes. And then there's a couple of tunes that I wrote. And then there was some Orisha songs that I think are very beautiful. I had a friend of mine as a drummer live with me for 2 years, Michael Skinkis, and he learned to play bata drums in Cuba, which is the sacred drums of Cuba, which is basically their voodoo. It's a similar religion, and they play this very complex 6/8, 4/4 stuff. It's like they'll play two interlocking rhythms at the same time. And it's very complex, and it's all memorized. It's not, you're not jamming ever, hardly. There's points where you kind of do, but basically it's all very meticulous. It's all, because the idea is it's religious drumming. If you do it wrong, then the Orisha or the spirit or that God or whatever you want to call it will not appear if you do it wrong. So what's interesting about these songs, I learned to play he taught me some basic, I can do the Oro Seco and many songs on the smallest drum, which is the simplest drum. And this is something I learned when I was in my late 50s, and I thought it was great to learn a whole new aspect of music that late. And it was hard to learn, but man, when I learned it, it was like, oh my God, it was such, and it brought a lot. My playing is much more accurate rhythmically now because of that. But these songs are, because they don't want to change them, or they change very slowly. Of course, they will change because it's not written down. But because, you know, they have, it's like a formula. You have to sing this song, do this dance, play this rhythm, and then they possess someone. The spirit will possess someone with whatever Orisha that you're doing. You know, like if it's Oshun, the goddess of love, which is what I played one of her tunes on my CD. Then she will come and take over somebody's body. And I've seen it. I've done a few. Ceremonies with some Cuban. There's a Cuban community in Kenner that do that in their house, and but what is, because it doesn't change, what you have is melodies that are very ancient, because this religion predates Christianity. You know, it's very much like the Greek mythology, that the various gods. There's, you know, there's Venus. And there's the you know, the guy underground with the iron and the
Hades,
and all of these, all of the Greek ones have counterpoints in both the voodoo and the Santeria. It's interesting. So it's probably, they're probably related somehow. But so it's pre-Christian, so you know you're playing melodies that are ancient. So it's like root melodies. They're very simple, but they're very eerie. They sound like Chinese melodies or Irish melodies, like the old Irish stuff, you know, the one with the flutes and Gaelic, you know. Old, it's like they're really, I find that these melodies are like real essential. They must be like really something that comes out of the human spirit, you know.
Do you believe in the healing power of the music? Of music specifically in this and then also in general, considering you spent so much of your life doing it?
Huh.
Or I'll rephrase it. Have you watched or experienced music changing people?
You mean like some drunken lout jumping up and down in front of the Acura stage? You know, you mean for a better way. Well, a friend told me this. A friend had died very young, and he was a really, I don't know, he was an editor of L.A. Style magazine. In it, you know, it was like, anyway, he told me, he said, and I'm supposedly an atheist. That's the way I was brought up, to be an atheist. My parents were atheists. I mocked religion as a young man. Later, it didn't bother me that much. But he said, like, do you believe that music is more than the notes and the sounds that you play? Is more than that physical product that moves molecules in the air that you create? Is there more to it than that? And he said, and I said, yes, I guess I do. And he said, you know, you would have to play music so long for so little money, for so little reward. If you basically chose a life of poverty. You must believe that there is something in music that is more than just the notes. And more than just the response, the feeling as a response. Of course, everybody accepts there is an emotional response to music. Is it more than that? And I said, I think it is. In a way, I think, like, in a way, it's my religion. I believe there's something spiritually there. He says, then you believe in God, in a sense. So he told me that I believed in God, which is pretty interesting because he's kind of a, in a way, he's kind of a, or he's dead now, he's kind of a, he was kind of an atheist too himself, but he wasn't, you know. So I would say I must believe that music does change. If I thought it really healed, man, I would be playing music, healing music every day, trying to self-heal myself. I think positive emotional experiences are good for you. But I do believe music is more than a positive emotional experience. I do think that it, I don't know how to say it. Well, one thing, if you could say it, you wouldn't have to play it. You know, it's not, you know, you write a play, that's words. You play music, that's music. And if you could do it by saying it, then you could eliminate the music and just do words. Words is a different thing. Music is a different thing. And music, the answer to the question is a sound, kind of, almost. You know what I'm saying? That there is really no adequate answer to the question because you're dealing with language there. So, but I obviously must feel that there's some really positive thing in music for me to you know, put this much time in. Especially when you get older, you know, and you're not like like some rock kid or something. You don't get that kind of reaction from people, and it's, you know, you don't have that kind of fun aspect of it. You have to keep going. I think I have to believe it. It has some kind of power. I'm not sure what.
Where are you at right now in terms of, like, you know, you were raised an atheist or as?
Oh yeah.
Do you have an opinion right now about what happens afterwards?
Yeah, I think that's something I think about more. I always used to think about it. I don't know. I'm afraid. I really am afraid that it's like, you know, it's like your body, if you cut off your finger, you know, you That's you. This finger is you. You cut it off and throw it on the floor. That finger has no consciousness. I think it's just nothing. It's gone. And it's sad because I think I'm going to behave very badly near the end because it's very frightening to let go of something. And then for eternity, there's nothing. So that's very scary. And that scares me a lot. I think, I'm having to face my death. And I don't know how well I'm going to do at it because I don't believe in an afterlife. I find that highly improbable. Also, I got to tell you why. Because I sat next to both of my parents at the moment of their death. And when they died, they were both laid out pretty much in bed at home, you know, and which is the way I'm going to die. And there's a moment when they're almost dead anyway, really, at a point, you know, if they're like out for a couple of days, it's basically a body, but they're alive and they're there. The second they die, there's no difference because they're not moving. The second they die, they look different. The second they die, the second they take the last breath, it changes from my father to a body like that. And I think, to me, the soul, I do believe in the soul. I don't believe the soul it lasts forever or stays the same. I think the soul is more like a verb. In a sense, like the soul. See, I think our language screws us up. Because you say, soul, what are you even a soul? Well, that's a noun. Therefore, the soul must be a thing because we've just described it with a noun. But really, the soul is a verb. The soul is an action in a way. It's a movement. It's a process. And it's not a thing at all. So really, you don't lose a thing when you die. It's not a thing. It's a kind of a, it's hard to say. It's a movement. It's a something holding together events in your life. It's something that you are. It is, but it's not a noun. So it doesn't go anywhere because it never was anywhere. It never is anywhere. Where is your soul now? Is it in your brain or is it in your finger, the one you cut off and threw on the floor? Hope it's not there because you're out of luck if that happens. So it's, I mean, no matter what you cut off, you still are there right until you kill yourself. So it's not anywhere because it's not a noun. It doesn't exist anywhere. It is a process. So when that process stops, it's all over, I think. And that's very scary because I really like living. And I would, you know, like to have an afterlife that was, you know, involved with, you know, friends and maybe you could get laid. Who knows, you know, what goes on. But I don't believe it. So I have nothing to lean on. It's really hard to die if you've got nothing to lean on. Except, I'll tell you what I do. I really do, my family, my children, just knowing is a comfort. But man, you got to die alone, completely alone. That's the tough part.
So you were there for both of your parents. I can't help but think that your kids would want to be there with you.
They probably will be, sure.
Can you think of anything that would help them deal with it better than you did?
Well, I dealt with it pretty good. I mean, it's a big event. It's something that you deal with it as if a big event has happened, because it has. So it's huge. But I wasn't devastated at the time. And my father was a wonderful, wonderful man, a painter, an artist. He was a very funny guy, a wonderful guy, and I love him very much. But yeah, they'll deal with it fine. They'll probably do better than I did.
If you had it all to do over, can you think of anything you'd
do differently? With my life?
Oh, your whole life, my man.
If I had to do it older, I wouldn't be. I would have had to take drugs just to see what they were like. But I wouldn't, after you did it a couple of times. When it became repetitive, I think I would have liked to have not done it anymore. I would have liked to stop drinking earlier. I wish I could have a glass of wine a day because I love red wine. But I wish I had not taken the alcohol and the drug thing as far as I did. Because I tell you, man, I drank easily as much as Alex.
Oh, that's bad.
And I was taking cocaine. And I was a heroin addict, and I was taking methadrine, and, you know, so I was, you know, as well as, you know, you had to take, when I was in San Francisco, you had to take LSD, didn't you? That's some scary stuff. You probably know that. I don't know. Well, this is my story, goddammit.
Well, where, seeing as how you've experienced the whole rainbow, where would you put morphine?
Well, it's kind of a drag. It doesn't do much. I woke up the other day, I forgot to take my morphine. I woke up in the morning, my bed was soaked. I had shivers and my hands were moving like this and I ached all over. And I went to get some aspirin. The bottle flew out of my hands. And I'm going, oh my God, the cancer is so bad. It's just cut through everything and this is it. And I was going, oh man, this is really, I'm really not ready. I'll be ready, but not now, okay? And I was really scared. And then I went like, oh, yeah, I'd done withdrawal once before. And I go, this is withdrawal. I forgot to take my morphine. When you take morphine for pain, it kills the pain, but it doesn't give you, it kills the pleasure too, you know what I mean? You don't, if you have pain, you don't get high.
I got one last question.
Okay, yeah, let's get more positive or something.
Well, I think we can probably both agree that there's no way of knowing what's going to happen. If you could pick the heaven of your dreams, what would happen afterwards? Like, what's it like and who's there?
Oh, man. Well, it would have a lot of beautiful women that I've been chasing and I haven't caught. They would be there, especially maybe one that I won't mention by name because she isn't, you know. She's not mine. She's somebody else's. I would be kind of like, you know, what do I know? This life. I kind of like this life. A lot of friends, you know. Nice shotgun house in the Bywater. It would be like this, I guess.
Wouldn't change a thing.
Well, not too much. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. I guess not.
So how do you know you're not already there?
Well, yeah. Well, there's some things that aren't quite right. So I'd say on a lot of levels, you know, we didn't even talk politics, man.
That's pretty much the last thing.